Stop trying to make Fetch happen.
But Fetch is from the same town that you are. Fetch has letters to their mom.
Fetch donates to charity. On Fridays, Fetch wears pink. Live from Mundangerous's tragic flashback in New York City, I am your host, Shane.
And I'm your host, Ishan.
And welcome to episode 310 of Total Party Thrill, the podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're talking about creating and playing endearing and likable villains. But first, the party browses Crystal in the Gates of Morning campaign. And later, Carmen Sandiego is somewhere in the world in the Character Creation Forge.
Ishan, where in the world is Carmen Sandiego?
That's the question, Shane. Or maybe even where in time is Carmen Sandiego?
That's the sequel.
And a much worse game.
Definitely. Also, not a game show. Not a game show at all.
34 hours to find her in all of history? Also, she got kind of genocidal in that game. I think one time she stole the history of medicine. That's a...
Oops.
Yeah. Whoa. Oops, all smallpox.
Oops, all anti-vax.
That's what's under that red trench coat. Mercury.
All right. Well, where are we at the Gates of Morning campaign?
So the Gates of Morning campaign is our 5th edition D&D game set in Eberron, a sequel of sorts to the original Morning Glory campaign. And in Fairhaven, the peaceful capital of Ondair, the party is hunting down Quarry Mindseeds. The party has finally shattered an illusion that hid a 200-foot-tall Raedrin tower, seemingly from the entire city. They know that this is one of the fabled Hanbalani Altas, which Vesikad, the Kalishtar, knows are used to control the minds of the Raedrin people. What it's doing here in a city in Corvair, they don't know yet, but it can't be good.
So as the party descends from their vantage point in the bell tower, they can see that crystals are now growing out of the walls and thick, fleshy growths pulsate slowly. The dust here is less thick, and it's apparent that there's been movement recently. In the courtyard, the Hanbalan looks like it used to have entrances around its base that are now sealed with smooth stone.
Lenore approaches it and presses a palm to one of the seals, and after a moment decides to use the Raedrin passphrase, "On the psyche, no scars remain." The stone seal melts open, revealing 4-foot-thick metal walls and a hollow interior. A bright green glowing crystal core 10 feet in diameter stretches from the ground all the way very nearly to the top of the ovoid 200 feet above their heads. But Ward notices that the ceiling doesn't quite reach all the way to the very top.
So Bramble grabs Zan and dimension doors above the ceiling, and they arrive in a small chamber at the apex. The floor is made of clear crystal, and the green core glows up through it to touch the ceiling. Small portholes allow a view into the distance outside.
Out of the ground, a crystal dais grows, atop which sits 4 crystal rods, set in an arcane configuration. The pair drops a long, long rope down for the others to climb up. And now, with the party reunited at the very top, Vesikad and Zan tinker with the apparatus, long enough to figure out how to channel magical energy into the crystals, which they assume controls the monolith somehow. But while they think they can change the settings, they have no idea what any of those settings actually do.
After some more study, Zan is able to discern 4 or 5 configurations that seem often used because the crystals slide more easily into place. He also finds 2 that are rarely used. The party decides one of these will shut down the monolith.
One of them. Zan tries the first configuration. His channeling is successful, and the core glows a brighter green. From inside the cathedral, they hear an inhuman roar. To find out what's going on, Warden wild shapes into an air elemental to scout it out. And flying around above the ceiling of the cathedral, he can see that one of the fleshy growths has burst open, and now he can see a humanoid with tentacles ambling through the halls. He flies back, returns to the apex, and Zan tries the other configuration.
At first, the warlock is unable to properly channel the energies into the crystals, so he tries again and again, nearly succeeding. Finally, he feels something within the apparatus break, and the core begins glowing more and more brightly. No matter what he tries with the crystals after that, they won't accept any more input.
The core continues to brighten, and now that's accompanied by a high-pitched whine. Deciding this can't be a good thing, they abandon the monolith. Bramble and Lenore dimension door across the street with Zan and Switch. Warden, still in air elemental form, grabs Vesicod, carries him all the way down the hollow shaft of the monolith, out the previously sealed hole, and into the sky just as the core explodes with earth-shaking force, sending dust and debris flying out of the open sealated space. For just a few moments, the 200-foot-tall metal shell stands firm, before it crumbles from within into a thundering pile of rubble in the courtyard.
And we'll find out what happens next. Next week.
So this week, we're talking about making endearing villains. Because who doesn't love a cuddly antagonist?
Sure.
Yeah.
What I need is more moral dilemmas.
That's what everybody needs, of course. Like, we want to make you feel bad about winning. So this is a great way to give depth to an NPC, right? Like, we all love incongruous characters. We love people with multiple dimensions. And I think the lovable, the likable, the respectable, the endearing villain is a common trope because it works. It works well. It's rewarding for people to engage with, right? Like, yes, a cackling villain is fun to take down, but there's more room for drama in your game if the enemy is complicated and likable and maybe even understandable or relatable or someone the PCs might even get along with were it not for the whole, you know, we are trying to kill each other thing, or, you know, you want to win at any cost, or like we're vying for the same lover or whatever.
Yeah, but the usual methods of delivering this from fiction aren't nearly as foolproof in RPGs for one simple reason. Players hold grudges.
Yeah, uh-huh. Players take everything personally. And so if you do something bad to them, they'll kill you.
Yeah. Players are, you know, perfectly capable of finding forgiveness for an NPC that murders a village full of innocents.
As long as they don't care about any of those innocents.
Right, exactly. Nameless innocents.
Yeah.
Far less likely to parlay with somebody who stole their hat.
Right, I liked that hat. They stole my hat at level 2 and now we will kill them.
Or, I'm jealous of his hat, mm-hmm. and I will have that hat, even if his head is still attached to it.
It is a very fine hat. So this makes it really hard to keep the villain from crossing the moral event horizon. We did an episode on the moral event horizon where, you know, it's the point of no return, past which there's no redeeming the character. But, you know, when it is the party that is wronged, pretty much anything crosses their event horizon, you know?
Right. being slow to start driving at a green light is enough to put you on a player character list.
Right, like the line isn't in the usual places, you know? And right. You can't always predict where it's going to be. And now suddenly, like, you have this cool backstory and you want them to, like, get along with this person, even though they're rivals or, you know, you want them to be able to monologue or be interested or maybe even tempted to join their side or whatever. And like, it's just not sticking because, you know, they stole 10 gold when it mattered. When 10 gold mattered, they stole it.
It's also, you mentioned monologuing, and there's always that problem of, well, the players don't want to hear a monologue, but they do want to attack first. So
yeah. They do like to alpha strike.
The tragic backstory, undelivered.
All right, so let's talk about some methods to like actually make the villains in your story endearing to your players and not just your readers. I think one of the first ways to do this is make them irredeemable, but magnificent. The point here isn't that there is a way out for them. You know, maybe it's too late to save the villain. Maybe the characters do hate them for whatever reason, and they are going to stab them in the front for stealing their hat. at level 2. Fine. All right. That's okay. That can happen. There's already too much bad blood, or, you know, now you want to make them endearing and it's like level 15 of your game. The villain can still be dashing or charismatic or funny or brave, all in ways that are meaningful to the party, even if they're going to stab him. Right? Like, it may not keep them from running them through as soon as they get the chance, but actually that's kind of the ideal scenario where, like, as a player is like having their character kill the villain, you're like, I did like them though. This was a good character, right? Like, as a player, I'm a little conflicted about ending this NPC, but as like a PC, I really want to end this NPC.
Yeah, I think to set this up, you need to make sure that the villain has time to engage with the party,
mm-hmm.
right? You don't want them to be a kind of distant force. You want them to be a present, ever-present personality that they're dealing with.
Yeah, and you probably have had that opportunity already because, like, otherwise, why does your party hate this person so much? You know, or, like, why is there a grudge? And we've talked before about, like, you know, if you need to keep your villain alive because they need to do something for the story, then, like, just separate them from the party and don't have them go anywhere. But you already now know that you don't need to keep this villain alive, right? Like, they can set things in motion or whatever, but their real purpose here is to cause emotion in the players, maybe even emotional conflict, depending, and then to, like, die in a cool way because, like, everything they're doing is cool, right? Like, play them like a PC. So they should have similar tactics. Like, they should make good decisions. They should have big, important goals that, like, might align with the PCs or, you know, be completely contradictory to them. But, like, they'll quip. They'll make jokes, you know, in the same way that a PC will. Have them, like, walk right up to the fourth wall because the players are going to understand that this is an important person and this is a person that they can engage with on multiple levels. Right, both as a character in the story, but also as like a person who is enjoying banter.
I like giving them insight into the PCs, like kind of applying the GM's knowledge of who the players and the characters are to the villain so that it becomes more personal, right? They almost like, this is honestly like, this is the Mr. Chang, right? Ken Jeong's character in Community, right? Where like he is right adjacent to the party, right? To the study group, an antagonist, but like just charming enough and just ingratiating enough and just like always on the fence enough that it's like, we couldn't do this show without him. You know, he can't go anywhere.
Right. And he knows them, right? And it's not questioned why he knows them. It's because he's been there either in the background or whatever. And like this is a good opportunity. It's not that you want the villain to like know the character's secret backstory or whatever, right? But they should just be able to read them and say like, oh, you're greedy, right? And like, you're the comic relief and like, you're insecure or whatever. And then leverage those to either make jokes at their expense or to like make insightful comments that maybe are lighthearted, but maybe aren't, right? Or to even, they can even dispense advice, whatever, right? Like they're real people who are engaging with the party as real people and as equals. I think that's probably the most important thing.
Right. They're not deferential to the party. They might, I mean, this can even be like, they can be like acting like they're part of the party, right? Like, you know, this is like the, oh man, still the unrequited love, huh? Or it's like, did you guys finally make out? You know, it's just right. Like, we've been waiting, you know, like the, like you start using like group pronouns instead of like the us instead of me, right? And sort of referring to the party in that way. And then it becomes confusing for the players because it doesn't quite track, right? Like, this isn't what villains do.
Yeah, like I like it. I like the idea of them being like a fan of the party. You know, like, oh yeah, no, I heard what you did in like Clifftop. That was really cool and interesting, you know, and I hadn't considered doing something like that before. Maybe we should do that together. I mean, right now I'm going to drop you into this acid and like take your stuff.
They're irredeemable, right? So it's like, oh my God, I can't believe like the murders you guys did in Clifftop. Choice. I would have never thought to drop a delayed blast fireball in a silence spell to get away with it. I just brilliant. Just honestly, I'm You guys have really taken murder to a new level. I'm impressed.
Wait, you didn't murder those people? Sure. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. No. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, no, they had it coming. Yeah, I get it.
They were guilty shapeshifters. Yeah. Uh-huh. So was that orphanage.
Treaty of Thronehold doesn't apply to individuals, okay? Only applies to nation states. So I didn't commit any war crimes.
Part of the reason that you might want to do this is, like, as a GM, it's fun, you know? And actually, I kind of fall into this. I notice, like this was Behemoth, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, who was a jerk, and all of you hated him, but also you liked bantering with him and making fun of him, right?
Well, right, because we got to tell you how much we hate you.
Yeah, exactly.
Through Behemoth.
Right. I mean, this is a good opportunity to have a GM stand-in, you know? But also you can loosen up and just interact with the party the kind of the way that you're already doing it at the table as like real people.
Yeah, I do think that's an important caveat, though, with the GM stand-in, right? Is like, if you also give this character plot armor, then you end up with a Mary Sue, right? And so if they remain entertaining to the party and, you know, circumstances dictate that the party isn't able to deal with them directly for whatever reason, they can continue doing this. But at the moment where the party turns on them, that has to be validated with a fight, right? And maybe they can escape, right? But it has to be validated with, yes, you can do that. Yes, you can try to kill them. Yes, you can try to dispatch with this problem immediately, right? Like, the players have to buy into this kind of character, or else they're not a villain, they're a footnote.
Yeah, and I think that's important with, like, all the people that we're talking about today, they are villains. So ultimately, they're supposed to lose to the party, or, like, it's likely that they're going to lose to the party, right? So eventually their stories come to an end. So, like, don't get too attached to them.
Right, yeah. They exist to die.
Yeah.
But they were born to die.
Speaking of which, the next thing you can do with a villain to endear them to the party is give them a tragic backstory. This works great for a doomed villain. It also works great for a redeemable villain if you have a party that is potentially into that kind of thing. You know, it gives them a hook for, like, why we might even want to do that. It probably doesn't excuse their actions. Right. And this is an instance where it's easier to cross the actual moral event horizon. It gives players insight into what pushed them into those actions. Most players will usually feel some sort of empathy with them, even if, like, they find the actions abhorrent, or they think that in the same situation, they wouldn't have, their character wouldn't have done that.
Right. I think this is one where it is important that the backstory emerge from a third party or from a third, from a separate resource rather than from the villain themselves, right? So a monologuing villain talking about their tragic backstory is not sympathetic. Learning about the tragic backstory from the head of the orphanage where they grew up, that's that creates empathy, right? Or sympathy even, right? Like understanding that when they aren't present, then colors the next interaction you have with them. Right. And it might even be something where when they confront the villain, like, the villain has their own kind of reaction, right? They feel shameful, or they feel embarrassed, or they are angry that they've been discovered, right? And, like, there recreates conflict instead of resolving conflict.
Yeah, and it's a nice opportunity to sort of put a piece of information in the hands of your party and then let the characters decide what they're gonna do with it. Right. So you might have, you know, good or noble characters who look at that and say, oh, well, they weren't born this way, and maybe they are redeemable and we should try to do that. And then you have other more practical characters saying, oh, hey, trauma, we could leverage that. Parents died in a fire. Great. Let's get some alchemist fire.
No, bad.
I think it is useful to prod the PCs to think about what they would have done in the same situation as the villain in their backstory. And I don't mean, like, ask them specifically, or even have an NPC ask them specifically, right? But, like, you know, it's quite likely that some member of the party is going to have some similar element in their backstory, right? And so you can start to sort of bring that out, or have them think about it, like, what are the similarities, and, you know, how is it that your paths diverged?
Yeah, and you can do this easily by having a third party NPC sympathize with the villain, right? So have a third party make the case for sympathy for the villain's tragic backstory, right? So it's the headmistress of the orphanage is the one who explains what happened, and then also is like, I mean, obviously they're not a good person, but I mean, what could have been different? Right. Like, just so it's so unfair to them to judge them because they had such a rough upbringing or whatever. Right. Like when you posit it in that way, it becomes, it's an opportunity to lay out the case without having it come from the mouth of the villain,
mm-hmm.
because that isn't sympathetic at all. Right. Like that's just rationalizing your actions, which is kind of garbage.
Right. I mean, at best, or it's just like whining, right, while you're about to stab me.
Exactly. Or it's preening, which is kind of going back to irredeemable but magnificent. Sure. My parents died when I was little, and I was dipped in a vat of acid. And it's like,
yeah, I'm a PC. Do you want to know what my backstory looks like?
Exactly.
Here's a list of all my loved ones. Why are their names crossed out? You know why. I would not have them be pawns in a DM's game, so I killed them all before I even rolled my first die.
Next up, we have the impressive rival. So different from the bitter rival, this is the character that will best the PCs with flair or cunning, but probably not cheating, unless the party is impressed by that, in which case, hey, best cheater in the land.
I wish I could cheat that well.
This is the Danny Ocean, like, pickpocketing your wallet but leaving his business card, right?
Right, and, right.
Like, that's the move. Like, yeah, it's cheating, but like, I mean, it's pretty cool.
Or, the Racer X, right? Like, you never really know which of us is going to win in this particular race, because when it really comes down to skill, we're pretty evenly matched. Or like, maybe you're even a little bit better, right? And I need a party or, help or a patron or something in order to like match you. But like, I'm impressed by your skill because I do it too, and I know how hard it is.
This is Sacha Baron Cohen in Talladega Nights.
So I think this scenario is easiest to pull off if you're not dealing with life or death stakes. It makes it really easy to avoid the moral event horizon. Like, nobody's getting murdered when you're playing a racing game or whatever, right?
Right.
Or, you're vying for a position in the academic department. Although, I don't know, it could be a little murder when you're looking for tenure. I mean, that's a lifetime appointment.
Hey, Tez may well murder a professor, okay?
It's interesting. You haven't seen Kemble in a while. I don't know.
Yeah, stick around for season 3 of our actual play. Who knows what's happening to Kemble right now?
And I think this rival probably only really needs to impress one PC, at least to begin with, right? And then their admiration or their complaining about them, right, which is really just another form of admiration, will become infectious eventually, at least in a good party. Like, when one character cares about something and expresses that, other people begin to care about it. And one way you can demonstrate that they are good at the thing is to lean into the mechanical representation, right? So, there are story ways to do it, of bragging, right? I can do the Kessel run and 12 parsecs or whatever, whether or not that actually like means anything. But if the characters can see that the rival can like cast a 7th level spell, then the magic user in the group knows in game that that's an impressive thing, but also knows out of game that that's an impressive thing, right? That there aren't a lot of people who can also cast 7th level spells like me, or like I could only cast 6th levels or whatever, right?
How do you prevent the impressive rival from just constantly one-upping the PCs? Because that gets one note and exhausting, and frankly, just pisses off the players.
I think one way to do it is to make the impressiveness mutual, right? Like, I think this goes back again to, like, it's really helpful to make them fans of the party for whatever reason, right? Maybe it's for their own nefarious purposes, and like, I like that you're good at something and I want to turn you over to my side or whatever. But it also might just be like, they're in it, especially the impressive rival is like, I'm in it for the game, right?
Right.
And what do I want? I want another impressive rival because I don't always want to know that I'm going to win. I don't always, well, maybe I do always want to win, but like I need to know that there's a challenge out there.
This is the Doc Holliday and Johnny Ringo, right? Like the two deadliest gunslingers in the West happen to be in Tombstone at the same time. Johnny Ringo is constantly trying to pick a fight, and Doc Holliday is so adept at sidestepping it, right? While insulting him and belittling him, but not provoking him, right? And like he just has that element of cool about him that is so frustrating to Johnny Ringo that he eventually oversteps, and Doc Holliday is able to take advantage of him because he knows that Johnny Ringo is a better gunsman than he is. Like that's the trick, right? Is like he knows that he needs an advantage or else he loses.
That can be a fun scenario to put in front of your players, right? Like this person is better than you and you know that, right? You are good enough to know that they're better than you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a thing that you notice about them pretty much right off the bat. You know, you're going to need help.
Like you can't win straight up. You need to tip the scales.
I like that there are a lot of things that you can leverage here, right? Because if the rival can also see the skill or the ability or talent or promise of the party, then they're not necessarily always your biggest villain, right? Like it might be that I like having you as a rival, and so I save you, you know, or you know, I give you a clue about how to save yourself or what's coming or whatever. And like if you're smart enough or good enough or like a good enough driver or whatever, then you can get out of this. You know,
yeah.
And we'll see if you are.
Right. And the moment you think you could depend on that support is when they pull the rug out.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, right? They are a villain. You're never supposed to be able to like count on them, but like you feel good when someone saves your life, you know?
Right. Yeah. It feels better than dying.
Yeah.
for a little while. And then I'd rather be dead.
Yeah. I'd rather start over, play my second cousin.
So another endearing villain archetype is the redeeming quality, right? They're a typical villain except for the one thing about them that makes them different.
Yeah, because remember that like not every villain needs to be your BBEG and in-game villain, right? Like you can just have a hired goon who has a really good sense of style, especially if you know that like someone in the party would notice that and respects that. Right, if you have a fashionista in the group, put a hired goon in nice duds.
Right, or the you know the pickpocket who is publicly giving back to the community. Right, that the pickpocket who has a wing of the church named for them.
I mean, it's the Robin Hood thing. Like right, like Robin Hood is technically a villain, or like technically someone
anti-hero.
Who's not doing quote unquote the right thing, right? But like
right.
Everyone who encounters Robin Hood is like, oh no, I like them.
Yeah, they're all like, oodle lolly.
Golly, what a day. Or like the gentleman thief, right? The person who steals not for the money. They're like, they're not gonna fence this thing. They steal for the challenge of it. You know?
Right.
And they don't steal from people who need the thing. You steal from like, you know, a museum who shouldn't have a thing or a private collector who like doesn't appreciate it or whatever, right? But someone who has the best security system.
This can range a bit, right? Like, you know, it could just be, hey, they have a great sense of style, as you said, but it could also cast them in a whole new light, right? They're a philanthropist. Locke Lamora is a priest of a deity who is a thief. So he has to steal in order to worship his deity.
Yeah, I mean, your pickpocket might end up having letters from their parents thanking them for sending them the money, right? Like,
right.
When we first meet Jean Valjean, he is a villain. He's stealing from a priest.
Right.
Right? But he's doing it because he's desperate. The priest realizes that, and now Jean Valjean is our hero.
Right. They might also have something in common with the party, or at least one member of the party. They might come from a similar place or have a similar background. They, you know, might love animals, and so they get along well with the druid.
It might even be something as simple as like they like the same sports team as a member of the party or the whole party, right? If the party is all maybe from like one place. And this is not necessarily to say that this is a reason that your players are always going to remember this person and, you know, they'll talk about them for years. But it is a very easy way to just add some color to your villains. I wouldn't do this to every villain. I wouldn't do it to like every bodyguard that they have to beat up for information or whatever.
Right.
You know, but do it to some.
Right. Yeah. It's just a quick shorthand of, hey, this person is slightly decent. They have something in common.
Yeah, and like it is a good way if you want to sort of dial back maybe some of the gaminess that some groups can kind of fall into. Like, you know, you want to begin characterizing as much as possible the people that they're interacting with. And so you're just throwing one thing about them that's interesting. And because like they're engaging with this person as a bad guy, you present a piece of information about them that turns that on its head. And of course, it doesn't matter who the villain is. If there is a bigger villain and both of you need to unite against them, having a common enemy is a great way to get along, at least for now.
There's nothing like being number two and number three teaming up against number one.
Yeah.
You know, this is the, look, I'm evil, you're good, but they're chaos. And if they win, the whole universe is destroyed. And the thing about the universe is I live in it. So... I can't let that happen. You can't let that happen. Let's team up briefly, and then we can argue over who gets the spoils.
That's, yeah, the universe is where I keep all the stuff I stole.
Right, exactly.
I think this works really well if, like, it's the villain making the approach and being like, I think you need some help. You need my help.
This is the, literally, what the bishop did to me in season two.
Yeah.
Of the actual play. Was like, we're fighting, and then she's like, wait, stop. And I said, okay.
Why?
Why? I'm losing. I'm happy to stop.
Okay, we have a bigger problem.
This is interesting because it forces the party to see the good qualities of the villain, or at least the good qualities of partnering with a villain.
Right. Like now you have to hang out together. Right. Like you're going on a quest together. So it presents a moral line that the villain will not cross. Right. So it gives them boundaries. It tells the party like where they stand. Right. Like do you remember? I don't know. Maybe you're too young for this. I always think about The Rocketeer, which I think was from like 1991.
I am not too young for The Rocketeer, sir.
Okay. All right. All right. Do you remember near the end? So there's a mob boss.
I remember none of The Rocketeer, sir.
So there's a mob boss who's like a bad guy throughout the whole movie. He's fighting The Rocketeer all the time and like trying to shoot him and like trying to kill him, right? But then there's a moment when Timothy Dalton reveals himself to be a Nazi, right? Because it takes place during or like right before World War II. And like Hitler wants all these rocket packs so that he can like take over all of Europe. And
naturally.
And then the mob boss is like, he immediately turns on Timothy Dalton, like points his gun at him, and he's like, I might be a criminal, but I'm an American. And like, it's cheesy, yeah, but like, that tells you everything you need to know about that villain, who's like now no longer a villain because we're dealing with Nazis.
Right.
And actually, suddenly you have like a bunch of Tommy guns that you can use.
Yeah, exactly. Every gun not aimed at me is a good gun.
Right. And like, if you've done some of these other things, like if some of these hired goons have nice clothes and you've noticed that before, and now suddenly you're like in the car with the suicide doors together and they like hand you a Tommy gun and you're like, oh, hey, I know that suit. That's a nice suit. Right. Like it builds history with these characters.
Right. And then, you know, that proximity to their flaws can also be enlightening as to how the characters feel about it, right? Like sometimes it's fun to break bad.
Yeah. Right. And now because you are fighting a bigger evil, you kind of have to. Like you don't, I guess, need to worry about if there's like illegal liquor in the boot of the car, right?
Right.
Actually, maybe we're just going to drink it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, celebration afterwards.
But with all of this, I think there are some techniques that are helpful to make the villain matter at all to the party, right? Because you can always throw someone at the party and they say, like, I don't care, you know, or they're evil and I'm going to smite them, or, you know, they don't do anything to advance our interests, so we don't want to engage. One easy way to do this is to have the redeeming quality that the characters like about this person be caused by or influenced by the party. So if they've had interactions before and the party is, like, you know, on the less villainous side or whatever, and there's something intriguing about that or impressive about their skills or whatever, you can have a villain begin to develop an arc where they adopt, you know, they don't become good necessarily, but they adopt something that the characters like, and now they have that in common, and it's because of the characters.
That is a very reasonable technique that I am 90% sure no player will trust. So I prefer if the villainy is caused or influenced by the party, not the redeeming quality.
I mean, this is why Batman is so tied to the Joker, right?
Right, exactly. And so that way, you can point to cause and effect, right? And they feel ownership over the villainy. They might not care. I mean, you can't control PCs, but, like, at least they'll trust that it's true. Or they'll try to, you know, go through their 12 stages. Seven stages? I don't know how many grief stages there are, but anyway, they'll get to the bargaining stage.
It's five.
It's not
five.
Really our fault. There's five?
Right.
Okay. Well,
it's not our fault. If you have the right kind of party, you can present the villain as having an actual real possibility of redemption, right? Like, if they haven't crossed that moral event horizon, or even if they have, you could have them begin to come to terms with that, and then there's always a process of, like, surrender and punishment, right? You need a particular kind of party that, like, cares about that, you know, or cares about redeeming the villain and thinks that's an important thing to do. But if you do have that, then it is usually extremely important to those characters.
If you have a group like ours, then there's usually also a possibility of flipping the PCs to their side. Party betrayal is never off the table for us.
Yeah, maybe that's more interesting.
At least if they find a sympathetic ear amongst the party for whatever argument or course of action they're taking. Even if the party does bright line, hey, I would never join them. But, like, they do kind of make a point, right? Like, maybe their method is wrong, but they do kind of make a point, right? Like, we can't just ice them. They kind of do have a point.
I mean, maybe we don't help them. I mean, maybe we should help them. Maybe we'll have that conversation, but, you know, maybe we don't stop them.
Right, exactly. Look, maybe Stalin's going to stop Hitler, okay? Maybe Stalin and Russian winter are going to stop
right,
Hitler.
Yes, the real hero is Russian winter, yes. And then I think another way that requires a bit of planning or seeding ahead of time is giving the villain essentially the same backstory as one of your PCs. And actually, the villain may have even been born out of one of their backstories, right? Like, they may have essentially been handed to you, or you, like, built them out of a backstory.
Which is why you kill every member of your backstory, so none of them can come back to haunt you.
Obviously. Like, don't make that mistake of having a happy family.
Right.
I mean, above the table, you could say, please don't hurt my family, and the GM should be like, okay, fine, but you know what we mean. You know what we mean.
Yeah. If there's a named character in your backstory who doesn't have a fitting conclusion, they're going to end up a villain.
Yeah, I found a fitting conclusion. But so you get this, you can get this comparison effect, right? Where you have the character looking at the villain saying, you know, there, but for the grace go I, right? Like, we came from the same orphanage, or we came from the same town or whatever, or even just, like, we had the same opportunities and we're born with silver spoons or whatever. And, like, look what happened to them. And, like,
right.
I didn't. Was that because of the choices that I made, or was it because of, like, one freak accident or coincidence, you know?
Right.
Or is it because I know this party?
Right. Yeah. This becomes your dark mirror. Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So of course, there are some caveats with villains. We should probably discuss, first of all, villains are different from antiheroes. Don't confuse the two. Villains are not the protagonists. They do not advance the plot unless the players are specifically empowering them to do that.
Right. They are here to present the party with options. And then the party makes decisions, and then they react accordingly.
Right. They are the challenge. They are not the action forward.
Yeah, and I think sometimes you can get a little lost in the weeds when you start to build out your villains and making them more interesting and making them more well-rounded, right? You start to think of them as PCs. And while they can act like PCs, they don't have the same kind of narrative agency.
Right. Don't lose sight of the purpose of the villain in the story, whatever that might be. Like, you don't want their ancillary qualities to undermine their function as villain.
Right. Like, they're there to evoke emotion in the party, whether that is frustration and rage or whether it's, you know, elation and joy after defeating them.
Right.
I'll also say anytime you're dealing with villains, be careful not to set up straw men where you are having them espouse a position or like giving them a characteristic, and then because they are evil or because they are the villain, you cast that position or characteristic in a bad light. Right? Like this is like the old trope of like you know, only the villain espouses like, you know, feminist ideals, right? In like old movies or even modern movies, honestly.
Yeah, I guess the narrower case of that is focusing on like disabilities or racial persecution as the cause for them being a villain, right? That becomes very dicey.
Mm-hmm.
We can't all be Killmonger.
Right. Yeah, like I think if a player introduces a story and says like, you know, whatever, my character's an orc, and because of the persecution they face as an orc, here's how I feel about that and here's how I act, that's certainly one thing. It's quite another to be like, this person was persecuted because of something they couldn't help and that made them evil.
Right, right. And it's not that that is necessarily like an unrealistic reaction to a set of foul circumstances. It's that when these are the only reactions you present to those mm-hmm. circumstances, you paint those circumstances or you paint those people in a certain light.
Right. I also say, and I might call this the Strahd problem. I think I think it is lazy to just make your villains sexy.
My personality is f***able.
Like, that can be fun for a short amount of time, but in the long run, I don't think it particularly engenders meaningful interactions, you know?
Agreed, unless you're just going for shock value or, you know, you're teenagers.
Right.
Which is the same thing. Then the other piece of this, I think, is like, be careful about forcing the issue, right? Like, sometimes you have good ideas that are laid out and executed, and they just bounce off the players, and that's okay, right? Like, take another... You get multiple bites of the apple in an RPG campaign. It's mm-hmm. okay if one villain doesn't really land, or several villains don't really land, right? Like, don't try, you know, stop trying to make fetch happen. Like, it's okay. Just move on.
But fetch is from the same town that you are. I don't understand. And fetch has letters to their mom.
Fetch donates to charity. On Fridays, Fetch wears pink.
That's sort of important here. If you're doing all this work of trying to make villains cool and interesting and nobody cares, they're probably already like the game as it is. Don't worry about it.
Right. So, as with all things, variety is the spice of life. So you can't make every villain endearing, mm-hmm. but if you try to make some of them endearing, some of them will land and you'll enrich your story for it.
Yeah. Don't do this to everyone. Don't try to do this to everyone. In fact, an endearing villain makes a great counterpoint to your cacklingly evil, like, spite-hate villain.
Right.
So have fun with it.
All right. Do you hear that, Ishan?
It's just gnashing and wailing of teeth, and I just can't believe how sexy they are. That's a villain.
Well, if we're getting down with the villain, it's time to move on to the character creation forge and see what we procreate. But before we do that, let's talk about how we're... That's not the right verb.
Wait a second. Hold on.
Before we do that, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane at Mundangerous. That's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan at Evil Sans Carne. That's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show at TPTcast.
You can also email us at TotalPartyThrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrill.com.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram at TotalPartyThrill.
And join the conversation on Discord. There's a link in the show notes. So this week in the Character Creation Forge, we are building Carmen Sandiego. So Ishan, I ask you again, who is Carmen Sandiego?
Speaking of endearing villains, Carmen Sandiego is the world's greatest thief. She's a criminal mastermind and the chief antagonist of her eponymous video game series. Notably, she wears a red fedora and a red trench coat, and she's got multiple backstories, as any character who has had fiction written about them for several decades does. But she runs Vile, V-I-L-E. She has plenty of vile henchmen. And she is able to steal anything, specializing in monuments and very large buildings.
And apparently academic concepts.
Yes.
All right. So what's the build?
It is Chronergy Wizard 17, Scout Rogue 3. I have a feeling this might sound like a weird build for Carmen Sandiego for those of you out there, but like, bear with us, okay?
Yes, those of us out here who were recently playing the video game, Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego, as recently as 1993? Yes, we've been thinking about this a lot, Ishan.
It came out in 1985, so you've been playing, could have been playing for a lot longer.
Longer. I was playing it in 1993. I got a solid 8 years out of it.
Did you ever catch her?
I have no idea.
Mm-mm. I mean, it takes a while.
I mean, this is like, you know, the Apple, not Apple II, but this is like school computer lab computer, right? Like as a child, I have no recollection.
Yeah, in the library. All right, so race, human, obviously, but we're going to try Mark of Passage Human from Eberron, which trades that feat for +5 speed, +d4 to acrobatics, a +d4 to land vehicles for your getaway car, Misty Step once per day, which is a convenient way to get out of any handcuffs just in case someone did actually catch up with you. And also it adds Pass Without Trace to your spell list, which is quite difficult to get and an excellent way to make sure that no one is following you or can tell where you've been and what you have stolen.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we're going to kick it off with 3 levels of rogue. I know most people here are like, no, she's a thief rogue or she's a mastermind rogue. Yeah, I guess. Okay. But from 3 levels of scout, she gets these cant expertise in your choice of stealth, sleight of hand, or deception. She gets sneak attack. She also gets expertise in nature and survival. And remember, she's an expert in geography. She is, could be, at any moment, anywhere in the world, and will know where she is and how she got there and the flag of that, of the nearest port, and also the currency of neighboring nations. Okay, like she knows all this stuff, which is why she's a scout.
Okay.
Also, if an enemy ends their turn adjacent to her, she can move half speed without provoking, which is a great way to make sure that no one can ever slap cuffs on you.
Then from Wizard 17, we will get a whole host of spells.
And now keep in mind, she's a thief. Right? She's not a transmuter. She's not a necromancer or whatever. The spells that Carmen Sandiego picks are the things that make her better at stealing stuff. Sleep for guards, jump for second story work, spider climb, invisibility, knock, enlarge, reduce. If you've got something like this vase is just very large and unwieldy, I'll just make it smaller and put it in my pocket.
Yes, this monument is very large and unwieldy. I'll just make it smaller and put it in my pocket.
Ah, we will get there. You just wait.
Okay.
Suggestion. Hi, I think that's mine. Hypnotic pattern is a great way to make everyone in the room just hang out there for a little bit while you relieve them of their valuables. So wizard gets arcane recovery. Chronergy Wizard gets twice per day you can force a reroll of an attack roll, ability check, or a saving throw, and you get in intelligence modifier to initiative. She always goes first. She's always on quick on her toes. You get momentary stasis int mod times per day. You spend an action to incapacitate somebody for one round, which is another great way to give people the slip. At level 10, you can hand off a spell to someone else and they can use it, which I think she does quite often with her vile mm-hmm. henchmen.
Yep.
And then at 14, you have Convergent Future. In exchange for a level of exhaustion, you can make an ability check, a saving throw, or an attack roll either succeed or fail. That's one that you see. So either one that one of yours or someone else's. Okay, fine, whatever. The real reason we're doing all of this is because we need to be able to steal monuments. How do we do that? True polymorph.
Okay.
So the true polymorph spell has several things that it can do. It can take a creature and turn it into a different creature. It can take a creature and turn it into an object. And it can take an object and turn it into a creature. There's no limit to the size of the object.
Just a limit to the definition of object.
Of object.
Got it.
Now you cannot turn an object into an object. You can only turn an object into a creature. So I would say, if you're going to walk up to, I don't know, the Washington Monument, and what is that if not an object, you uh-huh. put your hand on it, and in a single action, turn it into, I would go with, a tortoise.
Not going to get away.
Exactly, right? And that's the thing. It only lasts as long as this thing is alive. So you need something kind of sturdy. You need something that's not going to run away from you. You just flip it over, right? And now you have a convenient way to store your monument and leave. Now, were I Carmen Sandiego and I'm trying to steal lots of things, you know, if you concentrate on the true polymorph for 1 hour, it becomes permanent until dispelled. Okay, but if this turtle dies, suddenly the Washington Monument shows up in my pocket, and that's not a great scenario for anybody on my plane.
Hey, is that the Washington Monument in your pocket, or are you happy to see
me? Hey, it was a turtle, and now we're all dead. So I think what Carmen Sandiego does is takes these turtles and stacks them up, and then uses the 6th-level spell, Flesh to Stone, and petrifies these turtles.
So she makes a Medusa garden of turtles monuments?
just to store them. Just long enough to store them, right? She can always turn them back into turtles, dispel it, and then boom, there you go. She has her own little Las Vegas wherever she happens to live. But yeah, does she have a portable monuments? No problem. And also, like, she eventually returns the monument, usually, you know. Or I guess
after the kid at the end of the game show figures out where she is, mm-hmm, then the monument goes back.
And puts the parking meter or whatever it is they're running around on the right country.
Yeah, I don't know. I was thinking about that the other day. I don't know what that game was.
Yeah. It was. I always thought I would kill, but whatever. I will say some feats are useful here. Keen Mind makes it so she always knows which way is north. Linguist gives her additional languages. I'm sure she speaks many languages, but it also lets her make ciphers. And what are these geography riddles, if not ciphers?
True.
And then Metamagic Adept, I would take Subtle Spell at the very least, because we never see her cast a spell, so she must be doing it subtly.
Obviously.
Mm-hmm. Right, that's definitely what's happening. Oh, and right, she's Chronergy Wizard because, like, you know, she can travel through time, apparently, so that's just thematic. If you want to do any other Wizards subclass, it's fine.
Yeah, that tracks.
Yeah.
I mean, it's... Yeah, I mean, sure, yeah. Like, technically, she is stealing via transmutation, but... Come on.
It's fine. Yeah.
She's stealing monuments from any point in history.
Mm-hmm.
Come on.
Mm-hmm. The history of medicine. It's monumental discovery. That's why she cares.
It's a monumental loss. Before we wrap up, we want to take a moment to thank our Patreon supporters.
Your support is what makes it possible for us to keep doing this show every single week. And supporters at any level get access to our Plot Hook of the Week bonus content. So if you'd like to learn more, you can check out all of our awards at patreon.com/totalpartythrill.
All right, what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We're talking about dice.
And in the Character Creation Forge,
we're building the Dice Goblin.
Well, that's it for episode 310 of Total Party Thrill. I hope it lived up to our name. But either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.